America Looks Abroad. Today we present another in a series of broadcasts by the Foreign Policy Association, a nonpartisan organization devoted to the study of foreign affairs. The topic of today's discussion is conscription and our defenses. The speaker, David H. Popper of the association's research staff. Mr. Popper.
Good afternoon. Perhaps you were among the millions of Americans who heard President Roosevelt last night, heard him reject the doctrine of appeasement with the totalitarian powers, and call for the total defense of all the Americas and the adjacent oceans by all the American nations. If you heard that speech, you will understand why our government has summoned over 16 million men between the ages of 21 and 35 to register for compulsory, selective military service. You will understand why the United States, for the first time while it is still at peace, is embarking on a program of conscription. Compulsory military service is by no means new in this country. A few of us still recall the Civil War draft, and a great many remember, through personal experience, how more than 24 million men registered for service in 1917. But then we were at war. Now we are not, although the possibility that we may fight is apparent to all. Then as now, only a small proportion of those who registered actually donned the uniform. Of the 16 million who enroll next Wednesday, it is planned to train only 800,000 men in each of the 5 years during which the Selective Service Act is effective. The details of this unprecedented national program are being thoroughly discussed and explained in the press and over the radio. Less attention is devoted to the reasons for the adoption of conscription in peacetime. Ever since the last war, a great many public leaders have advocated it. In 1920, when our basic military policy was being reformulated, strong military and congressional groups demanded that all able-bodied men be trained. They did so because they believed that such an arrangement would strengthen our military position, instill discipline and other soldierly virtues, improve the national physique, and educate our manpower for better citizenship. What was still more important, they stated that compulsory service was the fairest and most democratic method of providing for the national defense, since it struck rich and poor, high and low, alike without discrimination. Precisely the same statements are being heard today, and often from the mouths of the same men who uttered them in 1920. But at that time, and until 1940, this viewpoint was not generally accepted by the public. Army service was widely regarded as a disagreeable experience, which tended to rob the enlisted man of initiative and to make him just a cog in a machine. Throughout our history, we Americans have distrusted a large standing army. That distrust has assumed modern forms in charges, too often unfair charges, that conscription is incompatible with democracy, that it may be used to break labor organizations, or that it is an entering wedge for fascism here. Where the truth lies, each person must decide for himself. But this is worth noting, that when national security is threatened, conscription is adopted as a means of saving, rather than destroying, democratic institutions. Today, Americans have no more love for military service than they had in 1920, and yet they are submitting to its discipline. They are doing so because they feel insecure. The activities of the totalitarian powers have aroused both fear and anger in this country. Insofar as the fear is fear of direct invasion now, it is not shared by most military and naval experts. We are protected by our Navy and by two broad oceans. The Atlantic is and will long remain too wide for round-trip flights by airplanes carrying bomb loads. According to competent authorities, it is highly unlikely that an initial enemy force of many more than 50,000 men, with all its equipment, can be transported to these shores at one time, even if we should lose control of the sea. No vast conscript army is necessary now to meet an enemy of this strength. It is true that an overseas enemy might attempt to set up bases elsewhere in the Americas from which to attack us. To guard against that threat, powerful forces are necessary, but not a conscript army. What is needed for this purpose is, first, a first-class two-ocean navy to control the seas, the means of access to this hemisphere. Second, a long-range air force to attack enemy concentrations. And finally, a relatively small, hard-hitting, mobile, and highly trained professional army to wipe out enemy footholds on Western Hemisphere coasts. Why, then, are we conscripting a possible total of 4 million men during the next 5 years? In part, of course, because we fear that if Britain collapses, Nazi Germany may ultimately organize all the shipbuilding facilities and the manpower of Europe in a great crusade against us. But even more, because the fascist threat to our interests and our institutions may lead us into a war across the seas. The notion of another overseas conflict is not popular with Americans after their last experience. The Selective Service Act provides that trainees may be employed only in the Western Hemisphere and United States possessions. But if the conflict in Europe is prolonged, we may change our minds. We may feel that it is necessary to break the stalemate, as we did in 1917. At first, our assistance to Britain might be largely confined to air and naval strength, but ultimately a drive for victory might require great reserves of trained men. Should war come, our generals and admirals would not be content with a static defense which would meet the enemy on our own soil. That way lies disaster, as the French experience with the Maginot Line showed. For that system lets the enemy choose his moment for the attack and lets him prepare his forces in perfect security. In this sense, American strategy is offensive strategy, designed to protect the country by waging a war as far from its shores as possible. Hence, in preparing for the worst, whether it actually occurs or not, the United States is beginning to build up a great mass army, as it last did in 1917. Now, however, it is building on old foundations. The National Defense Act of 1920, although it did not include conscription, was written with just such an emergency in mind. Under this law, the country was divided into 9 core area, and the core area were grouped in 4 field army regions. Provision was made for organization in each core area of 1 regular army division, and again in each core area of 2 divisions of the National Guard, our citizen soldiery. Actually, this basic group, totaling 27 divisions, existed only on paper for many years. Meager appropriations by Congress kept the regular army at a figure of about 130,000, far below authorized strength, and these forces were dispersed in overseas territories and in many domestic army posts, making the training of large units impossible. But always, the skeleton of the great defense structure was maintained. Young men and war veterans, for example, were continually trained as reserve officers, so that many of them are now ready for service with the new recruits. Today, our skeleton force is rapidly being clothed with flesh. At the end of September, the regular army had reached a strength of 335,000 and was swiftly approaching the newly authorized limit of 375,000. Furthermore, almost 100,000 of the National Guard have been called up for a year of active service, as permitted by recent legislation, and the remainder of the Guard, over 100,000 more, is to follow shortly. According to General Marshall, Army Chief of Staff, conscription will bring the number of men under arms to 1,400,000 by next July, and this total is to remain stationary as groups of conscripts replace those whose year of service expires. The figure of 1,400,000 was not reached by accident. It was adopted because it constitutes the largest force that can be trained by the nucleus of seasoned troops provided for in the 1920 plan. The figure of 1,400,000 also includes 2 groups for whom provision was not made in 1920. First, the new Air Force, which is to have a strength of 160,000, and second, an armored corps of 2 divisions, or 18,000 men. These 2 combat arms are, of course, the stormy petrels of the service, for about them raises the endless controversy over the amount of air strength and of mechanized force which the Army ought to employ. As matters stand now, the Air Force is to be equipped with about 18,000 planes, something like 1,100 of them the expensive 4-engine bombers known as Flying Fortresses, which have the unsurpassed range and striking power needed to attack aggressors far from our borders. The Armored Corps is to have about 4,000 vehicles and may be further expanded next spring. As everybody knows, most of the new material needed for the Army, for a force, that is, of 2 million men, including reserve supplies, has not yet been produced. There are, for example, only some 60,000 semi-automatic rifles available today out of a total of 353,000 which will be needed. and the current production rate is 5,000 per month. There are pronounced shortages of almost all types of ordnance, especially such weapons as heavy tanks, anti-tank guns, modern mortars, and so on. Although the number of combat airplanes now in service in the Air Corps is not precisely known, there is reason to believe that it is not much, if at all, higher than 1/10 of the present goal of 18,000. Production of material on the scale needed is a tremendous task, and a good many months must pass before results become apparent. But we do have on hand large stocks of older weapons, very useful for combat. Rifles, machine guns, trench mortars, 75-millimeter field guns, and other types of artillery. That production of the most modern types has been delayed is not the fault of any single individual or party, but the responsibility of the American people as a whole, who did not appropriate the vast sums necessary for our mammoth rearmament. We ought not to assume from this recital of deficiencies that the country is helpless or defenseless. If the Army has been starved for funds, the Navy, really our first line of defense, is stronger than ever before. It is an M-Day force, ready for conflict on call. Because its personnel can normally be filled by volunteers, it will not have to draw on the trainees selected for service now. Just as in the case of the Army, the Navy is being built up with all possible speed. American policy now calls for a two-ocean, or rather, a two-fleet Navy. This year, Congress practically doubled the authorized underage strength of the Navy to an enormous figure of over 3 million tons. Where we now have 15 battleships, we are to have approximately 35. Similar increases are scheduled for all other types of craft. The authorized number of airplanes, not the number actually in service, has been raised from 3,000 to a tentative upper limit of 15,000. Ships take years to build and equip, and we shall not see the whole of our new, larger, and faster fleet on the seas until 1946 or 1947. Meanwhile, however, our forces grow in strength month by month as ships commenced years ago are commissioned. A new command of some 125 vessels, known as the Patrol Force, is now being organized for coordinated service in the Atlantic. What is equally important, the essential naval outposts for scouting and protection are being provided. In the Atlantic, we are supplementing our old bases by the 8 newly acquired from Britain, and in the Pacific, we are erecting a string of fortifications extending along a great arc from the Aleutians to the Panama Canal. The hastily revised plans for all our defenses have not been adopted without confusion. There have been mistakes in the past, and there are faults which persist today. Yet in spite of them all, an American military machine of the first rank is rapidly being constructed. By the middle of 1942, we should have, in the main, both the trained men and the equipment for our new model army, while our sea power grows apace. There is only one proviso. If the United States should become involved in war in the next few months, our defense plans would be thrown out of joint, and our defense preparations would have to be speeded up, just as they were in 1917, when war forced us to alter the carefully drawn projects of 1916. We are approaching an hour of decision, an hour of test, Secretary of the Navy Knox said the other day. America is waiting, waiting to see whether the test can be met without resort to open hostilities, or whether, by the irony of history, we are to repeat the experience of 23 years ago.
You have just been listening to Mr. David H. Papa, Research Associate of the Foreign Policy Association, who has been discussing the subject, Conscription and Our Defenses. If you would like a copy of the broadcast, just send a letter or postcard to the Foreign Policy Association, 22 East 38th Street, New York City. 22 East 38th Street, New York City. Listen in at this same time next week for another in this series of broadcast by the Foreign Policy Association. This program has come to you from the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.